Hi, everyone. This is Raquel.
Hi, and this is Jennifer.
Welcome to Madness Cafe.
This is a feminist podcast where we talk about women's issues, politics, and health and wellness.
And where those issues intersect. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Madness Cafe. Today, Jennifer and I are joined by Kara Tuttle Bell. And she is an award-winning feminist activist educator who has worked in higher education for over 15 years. Kara holds a JD degree from Vanderbilt University Law School, Master of Arts in Women's and Gender Studies from the University of Louisville, and Bachelor of Science in Political Science from Ball State University, where she graduated summa cum laude. She currently serves as the director of the Project Safe Center for Sexual Misconduct Prevention and Response at Vanderbilt University, where she also is a senior lecturer in the College of Arts and Science, teaching in the Women's and Gender Studies program. Kara is a frequent speaker and workshop facilitator for skills and theories related to women's empowerment. Kara lives in Nashville, Tennessee with her husband Lance and dogs Leo and Ponis. And she is the author of this amazing book, Drowning in Timidity, Women, Politeness, and the Power of Assertive Living. Kara, thank you so much for being with us today. We are very, very excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
So the first thing I want to say is this is the first time I have ever ordered a book and it came signed and you included all of these really cool stickers. I mean, that was amazing. And my favorite, where's my favorite? Yes, girl, yes. I was super excited and motivated by that. Now, tell us about you, a little bit about your history and how you came to have such a unique position within the university. And it's a lot, but how did you decide to write the book?
Okay, thank you. And I'm so glad to hear that because if you order directly from the website, I do throw in fun things that I have around that are speaking to me, and I'm glad people enjoy them. The book's available some other places, but you don't get that level of personal service unless you buy from the website. Yeah, so I grew up in rural Indiana. I was really raised to be a very well-behaved girl, a lot of traditional gender socialization, and learned to be appropriate and ladylike and pleasant and quiet. And I would say, you know, starting around adolescence, it didn't really feel like who I wanted to be. And I think I had this sort of girl power sense at that age, you know, the rumblings of that, but not absolutely, you know, but not a language for that and not a feminist identity at that point. But I loved politics and I loved arguing and people kept telling me I should be a lawyer. And, you know, I was considering that and some other things. But went to undergrad, ended up majoring in political science because I loved it. Again, a really good thing to do as a political science major is go to law school. I did go to law school. I was very timid even then. I was still trying to come out of my shell. Law school is very good for that, but it can be a very painful experience if you're not quite ready to do frequent public speaking and sort of own your opinions. But it made sense for me because it was what I wanted to do. And it got me where I wanted to go. Now, the career, to speak to that, has been, I came up through University Women's Centers. All the women in my family are teachers. So, you know, my sister and I both work in higher ed now, which is not random. You know, education was just central in my family and also just, you know, really held promise of the way out of that type of community. And out of a community in which there was a lot of domestic violence and domestic violence actually, you know, in the family home, law for me was a way to ensure some independence, but also then give me some tools to advocate for myself and advocate for others. Mm. I was doing general women's center work, which is like speaking with authority, salary negotiation, supporting parents and mothers. You work for getting spaces for them to nurse on campus, you know, if they want to nurse, do some self-defense. There's some workshops on understanding your car. I mean, just a little bit of everything that was designed to empower women in particular, but it's broad-based. It's meant to be an inclusive space on campus. which included addressing sexual harassment or sexual assault on campus. But this became a huge issue, national news, some more governmental scrutiny in about 2012 to 2014. And I was in the right place at the right time for this type of job. I mean, it's a job that's not for everyone, but given the experience I'd had thus far, which was working with both accused students and people who'd been impacted by those types of harms, I had the law degree, which is good for the compliance side because there's a really legalistic aspect of this, but I had the gender, the women's and gender studies degree. So I had enough like feminist credentials to be convincing to our community that that was going to be the, you know, the framework of doing the work. And so that's how I've gotten into this. And unfortunately, there's plenty of work to do. So, you know, I stepped into this role focusing more narrowly on addressing sexual misconduct in 2014, but that work certainly continues. And so I've been in that role at Vanderbilt all this time. Now, assertiveness is part of that. Assertiveness is actually part of all of it. You know, if a woman's going to negotiate her salary, she has to have the nerve to do so. She has to have the tools to do so. So a lot of the work of like feminism on campus is about addressing what you can, controlling what you can control, acknowledging that inequity and discrimination occur all around us, but how can you position yourself to be safer or to be involved, to be included, to be thought of, to be hired, to be retained, whatever it might be. So assertiveness has definitely been a constant theme in a lot of those workshops, but it's a really important part of risk reduction and boundary violation resistance, or creating healthy relationships by setting and maintaining boundaries. So that's where this all, for me, you know, kept coming back to, which I was like, well, this is the underlying issue. How I came about to write the book was in the pandemic, they closed campus and they sent us all home. And a lot of my work, at least in the short term, came to a screeching halt. And I was not sure what to do with myself. I mean, I love work and, you know, I'm a nerd. I love all the things about working on this issue, working on a college campus. But a lot of this, of the traffic in the center that I run here, was student traffic based on what was happening in their living quarters, you know, on campus. Now, in the long term, of course, we sent them home at that time, and we sent people back in places that weren't necessarily safe for them either. So the work picked back up. It's not just that they were experiencing sexual harassment or assault in the campus environment, but in the short term, it was kind of like a break or a sabbatical I was never going to get otherwise. And then this woman who had seen me speak a few years ago reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, why don't you have a book? You know, and she's a small feminist publisher herself. She really is also in the business of empowering women. And she's a few years older than me. And it was a friendly but scolding, tough love conversation that I needed. And so I was like, okay, fine. You know, this I can do at this time. I mean, it was just one of those things that really was the only way it was going to get done. She gave me homework assignments. So I turned in like a chapter a month, and I really wanted it to be very accessible and to be a tool like the one-off conversations I kept having with students and younger women in the workplace was this kind of coaching that often started with salary negotiation for them. That might be why they initially sought me out. And I'll help anyone do that. You know, I mean, I've texted my sister a script before, you know, when she was had an unexpected call, got a job offer. If we need to do it, you know, in a 3-minute pep talk, we can do that. But everyone will be more successful if we're not trying to cram and trying to hold firm and have nerve for 5 minutes once every 3 to 5 years. Right. So it's there's something more to be had here. And that's what I was trying to write about, was this goes beyond salary negotiation. If we're going to change our lives, if we're going to actually address gender inequity, it can't be the individual woman negotiating her salary and not telling anyone else about it and not bringing other people up with you. So that's how we get here.
Yeah. Wow. That's one of the things I loved about the book so much is the fact that further in the book, you delve into the conversations we're having with really young girls, young children, young boys as well, but the focus on their safety, their, we'll get into it more, but their potential. I just love that aspect of the book, mm-hmm. that it is something that we need to be working on every single day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like that you really come at it from a standpoint of, it's like you just said, it's not, don't keep it to yourself. It's not just about you as an individual, although yes, that is very, very important. But if you don't utilize it for other people, then, you know, what are you doing with it? Right. You're right. Just kind of staying in one spot, you know?
Yeah. It's a real missed opportunity. And also it doesn't change your work life that much, right? Mm-hmm. Just to get the job offer or the raise. You're still going to then encounter, you know, the sexism or racism or homophobia or whatever it is. Like that little moment, so many books have been written on that. Like when I was researching this, I was like, everything is, it's the same message. And also there's really interesting research that's come out. I mean, really telling research that's come out, which is women do ask now, like they do try mm-hmm. to negotiate their salaries. They're not always getting it. It's not just the individual woman's fault for not asking. We're still encountering hurdles, you know, even in 2024. And I love working with the college age environment. I do. It's the appropriate fit for me, but I know that I'm getting all of these 17 and 18 year olds. And what we're doing a lot is the work of undoing what they've been mm-hmm. taught already to get them in a better place to take care of themselves in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was a perfect segue because you start out chapter one calling it the politeness trap. Can you explain the politeness trap?
I can. When I talk to, I would say women 35 or over. And so sometimes I get invited to do women's lunches or breakfasts. And those are lovely events and I enjoy them. But this is where they start to kind of titter a little bit at their seats, but then they're not sure they're with me, right? Because politeness has a place. It does. I want us to be kind to mm-hmm. other humans, you know, but not prioritize politeness at all costs, right?
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's not the main goal of surviving every day, right? Mm-hmm. Is that we avoided all potential ruffles, ripples, you know, and conflict, because a lot of harm happens when passivity or passive aggressiveness is our approach to human interaction. Yep. I just don't think there's a neutral stance to be had. I don't think there is a neutral, right? So mm-hmm. I get very frustrated with a lot of white women, you know, honestly, who do prioritize these like social, you know, niceties mm-hmm. over having any real conversations or resolving a problem. Mm-hmm. And I do see it also in sexual harassment land where, yeah, we can survive a lot of terrible stuff, but that's not the goal. I mean, we shouldn't have to put up with it. You know, yeah. I do encounter some generational resistance when I'm talking to parents or I'm talking to women, you know, higher up in the hierarchy who frankly, I mean, and to be clear, I feel for them, navigated a different work environment with a lot of explicit sexual harassment and sexism mm-hmm. happening. But yeah, but the goal shouldn't be everyone just needs to toughen up and brush it off. It's then we're tolerating it. So my point is politeness has its place. And I love it when people use it strategically, but please don't use it as an excuse not to engage with the issue or the problem or to protect yourself or to advocate for yourself, you know, to just better position yourself in a relationship, whether it's in the workplace or not, because we're prioritizing politeness at all, you know, mm-hmm. at all else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I do think we were raised to, at least I feel like I was raised, I can only speak for myself. I was raised to honor that politeness above all other. And so in my own workplace with my own sexual harassment. I was like, it's not that bad. It doesn't bother me. It's okay. It wasn't until I saw the same behavior directed towards my daughter when I was like, that's not okay. Right. And it's like, why does it take the identification with my daughter to decide that something's not okay for myself? And mm-hmm. it's almost like that was so programmed into us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's and where I find that I can get through to people is I say, were you raised to be seen and not heard as children? And so many people are still saying, yeah, you know, and especially daughters, seen but not heard. But no wonder they're not telling us about what's happening to them, mm-hmm. about like who's, you know, no wonder it's getting all internalized with the anxiety and depression and, you know, suicidality and eating disorders. If you're raising them to sit there and be pleasant and smile and tell everyone everything's fine all the time, to be seen and not heard, we aren't creating change. We're just delaying, you know, what your actual goals are for them, which is to have a healthy, safe, and authentic life. We're perpetuating the problem where we're not really able to tackle any of this until they're in their 20s and we can begin again the work of undoing.
Mm. Right. You know, and then there's, and speaking for myself and, you know, probably some other people as well, being a Southern woman raised by Southern women and being a woman of color, politeness has a whole other level to it. And timidity and all of that, that there's a different level to that because it's don't rock the boat. Don't make anybody else, i.e. don't make white people uncomfortable. Don't stand out too much. You know, I mean, you don't, it all comes in together, but if we don't go beyond that, things are never going to change. Right. Like that. And you make the point in your book. In fact, you write on page 42, and this kind of like draws in a lot of different things, but you say to live assertively and authentically, I believe that I must also be increasingly committed to anti-racist, anti-discrimination efforts, education, and action. The year 2020 fully convinced me that it is white women who are most prone to drowning in timidity, and the consequences for all of us are dire.
Ooh.
Yes, it is. It is all of us. We are all affected by this. And, but again, speaking as a woman of color, if white women are not also trying to do the work of not drowning in timidity, then that affects my ability to do the work of not drowning in timidity.
Woo!
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I've seen that on different teams that I've been on, you know, also in different workplaces, because mm-hmm. where I worked in Chicago and where I work in Nashville are very similar on paper, but they are different in practice because yep. that Southern audience, I mean, quite frankly, the Southern audience likes it the more feminine that I am. So, you know, yep. depending on where I get booked in the South, I might wear my pink dress and heels and curls and, you know, which is so different than a lot mm-hmm. of the speaking gigs I did in Chicago, which was my like sleek brown bob and pants, you know,
yep.
and I do play to my audience because I'm trying to maximize persuasion. I want
of
them
course.
To engage with me and think and be on the journey. And I know I'm pushing against some like strongly held mm-hmm. rules of Southern society. But I think when I wrote that, that was the year of the black image on Instagram. And that was just
yep.
the thing.
The black square.
It was.
And I encountered so many white women who were really proud of themselves for posting the black square. And I might have even at the time posted the black square. I don't even, like, I'm sure I tried to be.
I posted the black square.
Yeah.
But we all got caught up in it.
That you could, it wasn't, I was yeah. like, look, that can't be the only thing you do though. You're not changing mm-hmm. anything, you know?
Yep.
And there's the idea that you, you know, can argue with certain people, but not others, but we're missing the opportunity there to engage with the people who actually will listen to us the most. Again, mm-hmm. prioritizing politeness. I mean, when it's their own children, which we have seen, up close and personally with the issue of gun violence.
Yeah.
White women do come out, you know, and are very vocal and are very activist, engaging in like traditional activist tendencies. But where are they on other causes? And so it was kind of that level of frustration. But it's absolutely true that we can't all navigate this the same way, right? Which is the challenge of writing the book, right? Because you want to write a guide that speaks to different people, but it has to be clear that, like, I, as a white woman addressing sexual misconduct on campus, I have a lot of room to be angry and to be grumpy, and people allow me to do that, you know, because they think, oh, who would want, you know, what a terrible job she has, or I'm passionate and I care, you know, and it's nice that I have room to do that because it can be very effective. But it is not true that all of my colleagues are given that same space to do that. It absolutely isn't. In different teams where there's a high level of trust, you know, we will speak openly about who needs to make the ask, because I might be more likely to get the yes than someone else who is at risk of being portrayed or perceived to be an angry Black woman.
Yep.
For the very same cause.
Yep.
And so I just like to call BS on that, because it's like, who has more reasons to be angry?
And I thank you so much for saying that and putting that fine point on it, because to recognize and to actually voice the privilege that you have is significant. And I really want people to hone in on that. That is very significant. So thank you for doing that.
I mean, I'm happy to do it. Been a feminist for a long time. So to me, it's like obvious. Like, it's obvious that we're so hypocritical sometimes about this. But, you know, I did take certain paragraphs within the book, which there's another way to write it. I could have written it in a softer way, you know, but I can say it and have people stick with me, you know, because of the whiteness or because of the like traditional feminine presentation, and they like grapple with their cognitive dissonance a little bit longer. So I therefore think it is my responsibility, right? Not to make them feel better about doing nothing. That defeats the purpose. I actually want them. And if they're mad at me, who cares? I get to leave, you know, be mad at me, but they're wrong. They should have.
I love everything you just said. They can be mad at me, but they're wrong. I love that.
But also if they're mad at you, hopefully they're a thinking person. They get home and they're like, I was mad at her. What was I mad about? And then they do some reflection.
Right.
You know, hopefully that leads to some growth. You said on page 10, change is fraught with risk. I feel like that's kind of what we're talking about, maybe not specifically for white women, maybe for everyone, but I feel, why is change fraught with risk?
The status quo can be the devil we know, you know, but it feels more comfortable than what could happen. So it's that people have the tendency to retreat into passivity because they don't want to. I mean, we've used all the phrases. They don't want to rock the boat. They don't want people to think they're too much. Who does she think she is? You know, or, you know, it is sometimes easier to go along. I'm fine with these things as a strategy, you know, politeness when appropriate as a strategy, not politeness above all other, values, you know, and behaviors in a meeting. And passivity, I mean, there's some days I don't have it in me, you know, I mean, like when we've had every meeting on Zoom, no, you know, I could not like bring it 8 hours a day in a Zoom meeting.
That's real.
There was something so draining about that. Plus I was trying to overperform to stand out and to be persuasive. And I believe that we need to like choose our battles. So I'm not asking everyone to like go hard at it all the time, but nothing will change if you don't try. So if we are not happy with where we are at work, in our relationship, with our parents, with our partner, whatever it is, yes, there's going to be a risk there, because what we're going to do is advocate for ourselves, some want or need or some change, and that doesn't have to be accepted. Like, that's what people have to understand. This isn't a cure-all. It's a communication strategy. So you'll never get the change, the better relationship, you know, a more egalitarian, you know, work arrangement or sharing of chores or more sex or whatever it might be. You're never going to get the thing if we keep expecting people to read our mind. And if that's your strategy, they're probably going to do what a lot of people do, which is just continue on in self-interest and not think of the thing that you haven't said, you know? Yeah. So it could be a mini risk, but it could be a major risk, you know? So that's the assertiveness depends on if you're just going to ask, you know, your boss for some time off, low risk, you know, if you're going to walk out in the middle of the day to participate in the protest, higher risk depending on your workspace, your safety at that event. Varied risk depending on who you are. So, I mean, I want people to embrace assertiveness as daily practice because then it becomes more routine. And then they're thinking through these things. They're planning, they're preparing. Mm-hmm. We're doing some empathy mapping of thinking of who's on the other side. So we can't just try to do it impromptu for salary negotiation purposes every 3 to 5 years. It's not working for any.
Right. Okay. So you just, that whole section of you talking just now was leading into what I was about to ask about. And then you brought up the specific topic I wanted to talk about. So if you could talk about empathy mapping and assertiveness as allyship, I would love that. Because I think those two concepts, I think, are really, really important. And I actually wrote in the book, on page 44, when you first brought up empathy mapping, I actually wrote in the margin, want to know more. So
I love you so much for guessing.
No, I'm happy to. I don't even know where I learned of that the first time. But really, if you Google it, you know, if like you search it, a lot of the things that will come up are about selling a product. Mm-hmm. So it's used in business to think of the customer. But you know, as a supervisor who's working on an issue that is very emotional for people, it's very personal for people. And I like to hire junior staff and help develop them. And it's okay if they like move on and do other things. There's also high turnover because of the secondary trauma in this type of work. Yeah. And all of that's fine. But what I've had to do time and time again is bring them back to focusing on persuasion. And so that's one of the aspects of empathy mapping. The other is, it's just a good thing to do about care about your other humans and think of things from their side of, you know, their point of view. But empathy mapping is going to help you be more persuasive. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to get someone to hear us, see us, understand where we're coming from, and maybe make a change that will make our lives better. Mm-hmm. So empathy mapping, and there are different diagrams. People remember the ones that like have, I think one of them is called the Big Head Empathy Map, but there's different ways to do it. You can whiteboard this, you know, in your conference room. You can do it with post-it notes. You know, I'm sure you can do it as a mental exercise, but it's just getting out of my own way. Because what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about what I want. I'm thinking about being nervous. You know, how am I going to survive this conversation? Mm-hmm. How am I going to articulate my wants and needs during this conversation? And a lot of times the assertiveness prep stops there. And mm-hmm. that's incomplete preparation because we have to think about the other person. And for me, I'm always trying to control as much of my day as I can to maximize persuasion. This is an exercise in building influence where you have no authority. Right? So if I have no actual authority, you know, then I need people to agree with me or go along or be like, worth a try. So, you know, I try to dress for my most important meeting and time the ask at a, like when I think they're most likely to say yes. So I don't grab a high-ranking person who has the ability to tell me no when they're tired and exasperated about something else.
Yeah,
and
right.
I, you know, it's not enough that I just want it. You know, mm-hmm. why do they need to say yes? How do they benefit from saying yes? So I go back to my team where I have the number of social workers who you know, come to be victim advocates. We're right. Again, this is what I tell them. I'm like, look, we're the anti-sexual misconduct people. We're right. I'm right when I walk into the room. You know, we care about humans. We want this to stop. We want, you know, people to be safe. Of course, we're right. But you also have to be effective. And if we're asserting ourselves for some reason, we want the yes there. We want the change. We want the raise. We want whatever it is. And so empathy mapping helps you prepare for that particular conversation, person, their barriers, their concerns. It makes your whole conversation much more efficient. So even if your motivation is to like get out of there as quickly as possible, empathy mapping is a tool for you. It really is. Okay. Assertiveness is allyship. There is no allyship without assertiveness. There isn't. Believing is simply not enough. The black square is not enough. That costs you nothing, probably. Maybe one family member raised eyebrows that you participated. But at the end of the day, that is a fleeting moment. So if you're going to be an active ally, you know, I mean, I'd love for you to be an accomplice, you know, or a co-conspirator. But if you want to be an ally, then you have to do something. And that is going to maybe be fraught with risk, right? Which we've discussed, probably less risk than people are imagining. You know, they're really thinking of fleeting harms of people will think that you're butting into their business. That's the main thing I hear is like, well, I was raised to mind my own business. Well, sure, sometimes it is your own business, but I would say if something's happening in front of you in, you know, in a public or community setting, right, they're making it your business. If it's happening in the home and you're impacted by that, which you probably are, it is also your business. And the other thing that I encounter is people who are like, want to say business is business. And I'm like, no. Like, it's not personal. No. I'm like, it's all personal. We are persons.
Everything is personal.
Everything is personal. You know, it's like there is no business that isn't personal at the end of the day because people are impacted. You have to have the nerve to be, you know, one of the terms we use is an active bystander. And you can't be an active bystander without having a little bit of assertiveness, because I'm asking you to see something, to maybe take a second look, right? Which is to remain invested. Please don't turn and just mind your business. And then you have options. One of those options might be to confront the situation directly. That's not always safe for everyone. That feels really bold and risky. And it's not what most people choose to do. And that's okay. Right. What I would address now as a 46-year-old like director of my office on campus, I'll address a lot of things directly. If I see an escalating argument on campus, I'm just going to walk up to them and be like, hey, is everything okay? I mean, I will at this point. 19-year-old Kara would never have done it. I would have walked past it. I would have been concerned for the humans and I would have thought about it for like days and maybe weeks later, but it would have done nothing. Yeah. So what this conversation in the book is about, and a lot of the trainings that we actually do, are designed to run through scenarios so that people can find that assertiveness and that confidence more quickly, and they can act. So we're not just smiling sympathetically at the person being harmed, you know, and doing nothing. That's better than absolutely nothing. I mean, I will take the sort of commiseration. I'll take the circling back with them later and asking if they're okay. But is that creating change in your office, you know, in your work? It's not creating change. They appreciate maybe that you care enough to come ask later. But what they would really appreciate is someone other than them having to take on the problem by themselves over and over. So allyship is, you know, actually what we were talking about earlier is if I'm navigating the world with all this privilege, then I have a responsibility to use it for good and to take those moments where I'm actually not going to get as much blowback or harm to address something. Whereas other people, you know, with different identities, different roles might face much steeper consequences.
Thank you so much for saying that. And I just want to point out that in the book, you have a lot of different exercises and things in here to help people sort of find their inner assertiveness and to bring it out. And one of the ones that I flipped to was the section where you have my assertiveness models and or my assertiveness role models.
What did you put in?
Oh, okay. So
Page is that? Let me see what I put in.
It's on page 82. And I love this because you say identify your ambition role models. I love this. And so I put Pink, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Oh, I put her too.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Viola Davis.
Cool.
Gabrielle Union and Joy Reid.
Oh, you went on.
There are so many more women that I could have put, but those five women for sure, like immediately popped into my head. And I was like, yeah, these women continually speak up and speak out and they stand up for other people and they use their platforms and they use their privilege.
They do.
And each woman has different types of privilege and different levels of privilege, but they all use what they have to help other people. And I love that. And just thinking of, hey, these five women do it. I love these women. How can I maybe incorporate a little bit of that into my own life and to do a little bit of what these women are doing? So I love that because I think putting that in there and the other exercises in there really help to meet the reader where they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's key. And you do that very well in the book, Kara. Thank you.
I agree. I think the exercises were extremely helpful, really easy to do, but very thought-provoking at the same time. It was like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. This is really like making the point stick through my own writing.
Yeah.
And it can be fun. I mean, yeah. I think like a lot of it is fun, right? So I was like I don't know if I wrote about her now, but like growing up was like Claire Huxtable was absolutely a role model. And I mean, I loved her. I mean, I watch clips, you know, of her now and then feel really like empowered, like I'm going to go get him. I think there was a whole year where I listened to Tina Turner's Better Be Good to Me on my way to work. It was a tough year, you know, but also it was like I needed amp where I was like, no, going in, you know, hot, going in fearless, going in armed. And Tina was like amping me up. And you just got to find the people that speak to you, you know, and make you feel better and make you feel more capable. And it's okay if you find them, you know, in pop culture. And I mean, that's yours is a great list. They all are like these kick-ass, you know, women. So
yeah.
I feel good just having you go through your list.
Glad I could help.
All right. I'm going to change the conversation just a little bit, as I like to do. You do talk about sexual harassment, and you say that many people continue to believe that persistence is acceptable when initiating sexual activity. I think that is a really strong point, and especially so maybe on a college campus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about that concept that persistence is romantic?
The misconception that persistence was romantic.
Rom-com theory.
I was just going to say that.
It is still, and you know, pop culture, media, YouTube, TikTok videos, they're not helping. It's really not helping. Mm-mm. There are lots of fun shows and our problematic faves, but they are portraying sexual harassment, sexual assault, and stalking in the same old problematic ways where it becomes kind of sexy afterwards. And I am having a lot of conversations with young people and you know, my team and I do, where we're helping them understand the difference between fantasy and reality.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about now, which certainly was not talked about in the 90s or the early 2000s when I was in high school and college, is coercion. So we've put coercion in a lot of our college and university sexual misconduct policies, where we're saying very clearly that you cannot coerce, which is that repeat pressure or intimidation, someone into consenting. So it's in the policy, it's in our prevention education that they're getting, if, you know, from the 18 to 24 year old age range, they're probably not getting it before. You know, it's my job to understand who's coming in. And I have nothing but bad news to tell you about the state of sex education, you know, in our K-12 schools before they get here. And I can tell when I'm talking to first year students and I'm saying things like, you have to abide by the first no. If they tell you no, you don't get to keep asking and asking. There's some smirking, there's some laughter, there's some concerned looks, because male fear of being accused of sexual misconduct is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
I try to figure out how to use that fear. So that fear is very high. The issue's in the news enough that they know that sexual assault is an all too common part of college, that there is a procedure now that is really, which is Title IX, you know, offices mm-hmm. on campuses which address the harm. They are very fearful of being accused. But what we're not doing very well as a society is helping them figure out how to obtain consent. So the persistence is really quite routine. Persistence, you know, for my graduate and professional students, for junior faculty, you know, again, I'm on the college campus, but you can apply this to any type mm-hmm. of employment, right? Who are your most vulnerable people in that sphere? They're probably subject to repeat pressure, propositioning, unwanted compliments, which they're not compliments. I'm saying that sarcastically because people are misunderstanding the difference between like, you look nice today, and then something that's like overt and sexual and unwanted and inappropriate. That is happening often without consequence, quite often, because what are the tools? Well, the tools to address it, we're told, are these laws and policies, but those laws and policies are requiring a pretty severe, languages like severe and pervasive, level of that kind of harassment before they will address it and take action, and anyone would face any corrective action or penalty for that. So in the space between, there is some room for assertiveness sometimes. And I say that very carefully because in no way do I want to be victim blaming whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I need, you know, the listeners to understand that, like, we all know here that there are going to be some times where people are not trying to hear your resistance or respect your boundaries. They are very clearly trying to violate your boundaries.
Yep.
So it will not work for everyone. And I wish no one had the responsibility, you know, for doing that themselves. But there are some things we know about mm-hmm. risk reduction, which includes assertiveness. And so I try to very carefully in the book offer those as strategies to try if you find yourself in this situation, but also know that it's not personal failure if it doesn't work, right? That the responsibility for those harms really lies with the person who is causing it.
Right. Well, you know, and I think it's important that you bring up, especially because you work on a college campus, there's especially with freshmen coming in and sex education not being what it should be, and relationship education, and all of these sorts of things that aren't being taught. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important in the book that you bring up, and it's on page 73 through 75, you have relationship rights.
Yep. One of my favorite parts of the book. I was like, I need to learn this and commit this to memory.
We all do. We all do. And I mean, in one sense, it's kind of sad that it has to be written out. But in another sense, it's a great thing that you went ahead and wrote them out. Because,
oh my gosh, yes.
These are so many things that we need to know, that we need to keep in mind. And yeah, you know, maybe just sort of in this sort of weird, nebulous sort of way, we're like, yeah, I should have the right to be safe, blah, blah. But to spell it out and put it in such specific points, that's important. That is key. People.
Everyone should get this and read it. Yeah, I agree. And,
yeah, like,
yep.
Print it out and put it where you can see it every day. I mean, whether you're in a relationship right now or not, or you want to be, or you're going to be, or you were, and now you're not, whatever. I don't care where you are in your life right now, whether you're a freshman in high school, a freshman in college, 54 years old, whatever. This is key. This is key. And, you know, one place that assertiveness needs to be is in protecting yourself in relationships. So thank you.
We could do a whole episode just on that section.
Absolutely.
Without question.
Absolutely.
It's good to have them written down. I mean, I can say so personally, you know, it's like personally and professionally, it's good to have things written down because you can come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because romance, family pressure, partner, all of this noise can come in and we get busy and we mm-hmm. go along and we can lose, you know, ourselves in relationships little by little over time. But yep. if you have these rights or I don't know if it's in the book, but I'll send it to anyone who wants it. We have a boundaries worksheet, you know, which is if you yep. just do it, fold it up, put it in a drawer, check back every 6 months. And then you can kind of see if you're losing yourself in a relationship or if the relationship's becoming unhealthy, or it's a way to check in and be like, is this good for me? I've already compromised on what I had identified as a non-negotiable. So how did I get here? And mm-hmm. what are my choices? Are my choices, well, do nothing and nothing changes, stay in the relationship, but try to change it. Is it time to leave the relationship? There's homework to be done here that helps us build and maintain relationships in a much healthier way than we've been taught, because, mm-hmm. you know, we've been taught that it's magic and romance and chemistry mm-hmm. and all mm-hmm. you know, these things mm-hmm. that are just floating in the clouds around us. And as if it's you either got it or you don't. But yeah. relationships take work. I mean, you talk to anybody who's been in one for any amount of time. We all know it takes communication. It takes work.
Yeah.
And the other person is probably not always putting you first. You mm-hmm. you need to be the protector of yourself in the relationship. And this is just one tool, hopefully, to help you do that.
I think that was a beautiful thing to say. Mm-hmm. We could ask you a million questions. We're running out of time. Was there anything that you wanted to tell our audience that we didn't give you the opportunity to say?
I'll try to keep it brief. One of my favorite things. And hopefully
you don't have to keep it brief. Just tell it to us.
Okay. I mean, it is in the book. But one of my favorite things that I found has been the most useful that people think is memorable, you know, from some of the public speaking gigs, is that I urge you to reclaim your relationship with anger.
Yes. Oh, I love that part. Oh, crap. It was one of the things that I wanted to talk about. So I'm glad that you're bringing this up. Sorry.
It's key, right? Because along with the politeness and the pleasantries, you know, we've been taught to really suppress our anger. I'm angry all the time. I'm angry all the time. I'm like stomping around all of the time. And again, now people let me do that. You know, they do, right? Because of like aspects of my identity, you know, privilege, they let me do that. But for me, anger is fuel.
Mm-hmm.
If people say, how do you do this job? Well, I actually love my job, but I keep doing it because I'm pissed off on a regular basis. And all of that anger is valid. And your anger too is valid. Your anger is telling you something. It is telling you something. So let's not be afraid of it. Let's not live there. I mean, I don't want people living in bitterness and resentment, right? It can be problematic, but let's listen to it and figure out what it's telling us, because it's probably telling us about a boundary violation.
Yep.
And it's probably telling you that you could benefit from some assertiveness in whatever is creating the anger. And when you've practiced assertiveness, it actually comes out in a more controlled fashion. So it won't just be an unpredictable explosion. So it won't come out of aggressiveness, because we've figured out ways to harness, you know, the feelings and to really maximize, hopefully, the effectiveness of our message. Mm-hmm. So we didn't talk much about aggressiveness. Again, you could do a whole hour on aggressiveness.
Absolutely.
But you probably can't get to assertiveness unless you tap into like some of those feelings like anger that's trying to tell you something that hopefully is driving you towards positive change.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. That was a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for saying that. Wow, Kara, we could
have talked and talked and talked.
Easily talked to you for hours. So thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very, very busy life to come and talk to us about your book. This was a fantastic discussion. Thank you. And thank you for doing the work.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. I feel really good about it, but you know, have me back anytime. This was great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, Kara. Okay. I just have to say, okay, yes, definitely. Love the book. And it's not a big book, people. You can read this quickly. But it's very impactful. But what I have to say, which I just love, and I feel like I'm glowing, but
you are.
having this conversation with Kara really just brought the book to life for me in a way that complements having read the book. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It just sort of lifted it to a whole new level, because it's such a good book, and the exercises that are in here are so good. They give you a way to put what you're reading into practice before you go out and put them into real life practice.
Oh yeah.
Which I think is really effective.
And also personal perspective.
Like, yes.
you think about the ideas that she's brought up and how does this apply to me, and what are my needs and wants? And again, why does the person I'm going to go talk to care about my needs and wants?
Exactly.
Before you go into that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. It's so good. And honestly, like I said, it's so accessible.
Very.
But it's incredibly impactful. Like, the information, just because it's a thin book, people, this stuff is not dumbed down at all. This is really important information, and it's presented in such a way that I think Kara meets the reader where they are. It's a range of people that are met where they are. It's not just this person or that person. I think, and everybody can get something out of this book.
Totally. I agree with you totally. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just got excited.
No, go ahead.
Well, I marked like 7 pages, read this at the end. So I don't know which one I should read at the end. What should I read?
Just the eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Well, she talked about maybe this one, because okay, I like it so much. And you said just now, meets the person where they are. So this one speaks to me so personally.
Okay, perfect.
She was talking about, how can I help my child reduce their own experiencing of sexual assault? Like, we all think that as parents, like, how do I? And she says she has 2 primary recommendations. The United States is in desperate need of earlier, accurate, comprehensive sex ed in K-12 schools. We know that. We brought that up several times on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't even know how our own anatomy is structured.
Yep.
Right. And then 2, we must allow our children to feel and express anger.
Yes.
And that was the point she was ending on as well.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
And we've talked about this, the embodiment. Our anger is telling us something about our own feelings, our own boundaries, our bodies feeling unsafe, something.
Yeah. Right?
Let's pay attention to it. Let's not suppress it.
And paying attention to our anger will help us to tap into our assertiveness so that we can be a better ally to ourselves, to other people, to the world, so that we can be a greater agent of change.
Totally.
Personally, socially, worldwide. I think it's so much is packed into this book.
It really is. I'd love to see this book as, you know, part of a health education class in high school.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've seen the health education in high school and they're still talking 4 food groups. I'd like to see something like this.
Yeah.
I'd like to see this as part of the package when you do your college orientation.
Yes.
Especially the parts about consent. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the thing we learned about consent before about fries.
Yes.
The part that still sticks out to me is that consent should be enthusiastic. If you're trying to persuade this person and they're not enthusiastic, they're probably really not all that into it yet.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
but give people, women especially, but all people, really, men, women, all genders, give them some space, some time to decide for themselves.
Yes. And to decide for themselves.
Yes.
You don't get to decide for somebody else.
And then keep trying to rom-com them into changing their mind.
No, no.
You know?
Stalking is bad, people. Stalking is bad.
Even if you're holding that thing out in front of their house.
With the boombox. No.
Yeah, the boombox. Stalking.
Stalking is bad.
I know we thought it was romantic in the 80s, but it's not. We did think it was romantic, didn't we?
We did. We did. Oh, so problematic. But that's okay. We're learning. We're learning, people. We learn and we grow.
I love you, Raquel. It was a great.
I love you too.
Great conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Kara.
Yes. Thanks, Kara. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. We will be back with more Madness Cafe next week. You can find us on Instagram at Madness Cafe Podcast or email us at madnesscafepodcast@gmail.com. Bye.